impossible to hold something with three fingers blown off. But the story is three fingers were blown off, and she was still, according to police reports, she was still holding the knife and still flailing. So that was the reason that they gave for the two shots to the second shot to the chest. And she doesn't die immediately. Wow. She actually dies when she gets to the hospital. Actually, she's semi-conscious after they shoot her in the chest.
Amazing. Well, this is, as you say, this is a significant case in the focusing in on and resisting, calling attention to the systematic, it is systematic police violence sustained at the highest, in the highest levels of the police community. We're hoping that it will get a little better. I'm concerned, given the current atmospheric pressure that we're living under, that these are not going to be good times for the people who are represented in this book and who, these are tough times. But again, let me tell people, tell her story, Eleanor Bumpus, and the police killing that galvanized New York City. And a very important book that you've written, and we appreciate that you took the time out to be with us again. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your good work.
Thank you for your activism.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. Be safe.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KBOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, those dollars were promised to states, to nonprofits, to tribes. They were contracted and we were counting on being able to do that work for our communities.
According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, 34 million households across America are energy insecure. The Solar for All program was set to provide funding to 60 entities that plan to create or expand existing low-income solar programs, and would have enabled 900,000 households nationwide in disadvantaged communities to utilize solar energy to reduce their home energy bills. And yet, the current iteration of the EPA recently announced that the Solar for All program's funding of $7 billion is being terminated. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to a solar executive whose organization had its Solar for All funding rug pulled out from under it. Erica Mackey, the co-founder and co-CEO of the solar nonprofit Grid Alternatives, joins the program to give us an overview of the services that her organization provides and to discuss the impact of the EPA's recent decision.
Hi.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Erica Mackey. She is the co-CEO and co-founder of Grid Alternatives. Erica, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, we had you in 2011, and folks can go back into the Sea Change Radio archives and check that out. But for those who aren't longtime listeners, why don't you first give us an overview of the mission of your organization, what it does, and then we'll catch us up to what the organization has been up to in the last decade plus.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, since 11 years, a lot has evolved in the space and in the organization. So it's good to say it again. We are a nonprofit organization, and we utilize renewable energy as our tool for a higher good. If you think about climate justice and a climate justice ecosystem, we're primarily builders and innovators in the space. So we, you know, build a diverse workforce of the future in the clean energy space. We install solar batteries and chargers, all for families that otherwise wouldn't be able to benefit from those technologies without our support, and in communities that often are on the front face of many of our environmental issues. So, you know, downstream from dirty power plants or having highways crisscross our neighborhoods, and are, you know, sort of paying the price with our health for dirty energy. And so Grid works to build a really different future for those families. So we install, we train people to get jobs, and then we also work in coalitions to push for better renewable energy and more equitable renewable energy policies in our communities.
So you mentioned the job training element. Why don't you expand on the opportunities you give to people who are formerly incarcerated and people who may not have had skills to be part of the green revolution, and how Grid Alternatives have shaped those lives?
The great thing about clean energy, particularly in the installation world, is like these are jobs that are right here in our communities, you know, in fields, on rooftops, you know, here at home, and can really lift up our communities. So everything that we do, we have this people, planet, and employment component. So it has three legs of the stool. So when we're installing for Mr. Rodriguez or Ms. Smith, we also are training people to get those jobs. So it's a both classroom and rooftop component where we train people. So we have something called installation basic training, where folks come into a lab and a classroom, and we have a, you know, multi-unit curriculum that we take them through. So, you know, it's everything from how do you implement safety on a job site, to how do you bend conduit, how do you wire up an inverter, how do you place panels, all of that stuff. And then a key component of that is the actual on-the-job training. So then folks go out to an actual installation and put their learning to practice. So, you know, we show them how do you lay out panels on a rooftop, how do you install them, how do you make sure you're safe, all of that. And that's really aimed at folks who are either, you know, maybe folks who don't have a higher education degree and or are really interested in the trades or construction, folks who are making a transition between industries or careers. Maybe they, you know, can't get a job in an industry that is no longer, or, you know, folks that often have some barriers that, you know, by going through this training program and getting lots of support can enter the industry. So, for instance, folks who have been impacted by the criminal justice system and are looking for a job post-incarceration.
Just to clarify, Grid Alternatives is not a solar installation company on its own, correct? You partner with other solar installers.
if you want to consider us a company, right? And it's important that we're a nonprofit because we're, you know, really doing this for a higher purpose. But yes, we're a solar installation company, but we only serve a specific subset of our communities. So in order to apply to get a solar electric system through Grid Alternatives or a solar plus battery system, you need to be income qualified and have an income less than a certain limit. And that limit changes by the county that you live in. So in Oakland, it's different than Los Angeles, that's different than Washington, D.C. But you and your family need to qualify income-wise to participate in our programs. And by and large, all of the systems that we're installing are free of charge to our clients. So you can kind of think of us like, you know, a solar company with a higher purpose. Now, we do also subcontract out some of our work to a network of contractors. And that's really important, too, because, you know, there are tons of mom and pop family sustaining contractors that are doing roofing work or electrical work or maybe even some solar work in their communities. And those folks are often hiring from our job training base. So, you know, combining the we install it and we train someone with we subcontract out the work to an installer and they hire people from the community is a great pairing.
So, Erica, why don't you give us an idea of the reach of your organization from its humble beginnings to where it is now, and then the crossroads you find yourselves at with the federal crisis that we're all facing to some degree.
Sure. So many years ago when we met, it was probably, maybe we're a little bit bigger than just myself and Tim Sears, the other co-founder of Grid. But, you know, we started in the Bay Area, just the two of us. We're engineers by training and had been working in the energy efficiency, renewable energy field. But we really couldn't touch and feel that we were making a difference. We were saving Verizon millions of dollars, but, you know, my neighbor across the street was having trouble paying her bills.
So your higher purpose wasn't to save Verizon millions of dollars?
No. I mean, I think everybody, including corporations, should be taking a look at our carbon footprint. And for us, it felt like where we wanted to spend our time was in our own communities. And, you know, we went from two installs in 2004 to, you know, now we have reach across the country and internationally. We have offices up and down California. We have an office in Denver, Colorado. We have an office in Washington, D.C. We have an office in Nicaragua, some remote staff in Nepal, and an office and some staff in Puerto Rico. And then in addition to that, in terms of regional reach, we also have a tribal affiliate that's native led and run within sort of the Grid Alternatives family. And that program, Tribal Energy Alternatives, works with 70 plus sovereign nations contained within the borders of the United States. So really substantial reach. And when we started, you know, we had a volunteer model. Maybe we did when you interviewed me before. And what happened is that people would start calling us and saying, I really need to come out to volunteer because I applied for a job and they said I couldn't get the job without experience. And you're the only folks where I know how to get that experience without getting a job, right? So it's that. And that then really expanded our workforce development as a key part of everything we do. So in terms of, you know, job training, we do job training out of all of our offices throughout the portfolio of work. And we also have a train the trainer program where we're working in places like Nashville or Illinois, where we don't actually have an office, but we're training other organizations to build out labs and run our installation basic training curriculum.
So why don't you give us a snapshot of your headcount in terms of staff and contractors globally?
We have somewhere between 500 and 600 staff across the organization, and we work with hundreds of contractors and are really building out a contractor network across the country to do a lot of the work where we don't have a footprint.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Erica Mackey. She's the co-CEO and co-founder of Grid Alternatives. So, Erica, in terms of your funding, maybe give us a little bit of a backstory on that before we get to the recent announcement by the EPA head, Lee Zeldin, that the Trump administration wants to end the Solar for All program, which is a $7 billion program that includes funds that go to Grid Alternatives.
Sure. Our revenue comes from basically trying to patch together any available resource to make renewable energy in our communities happen. And so we, you know, have corporations that donate, individuals, foundations. So we get a lot of philanthropy from donations. And then some of the scale that we've been able to obtain has come from cities or states, or potentially in this case, the federal government, creating policies that become programs that help incentivize or support all of our constituents getting solar. So, for instance, in California, there are a couple of really important programs. One is a single-family program called DACSASH, which provides support for single-family homeowners going solar. And there's another program called SOMA, which provides support for multifamily affordable housing development going solar. So really pairing housing affordability with energy affordability, which we know is already paired in people's minds. If you think about just like, what do you pay every month on your housing costs? A big portion of that is how much you pay for your utilities. So, you know, for states and cities, thinking about how are we going to think about energy affordability for all of our constituents and then creating programs. And that's kind of a way to get to what you're asking about Solar for All, which was a national grant opportunity where each state across the country and nonprofits and tribes could apply to a pot of money to basically make sure that we could have lower income Americans having access to renewable energy. And so Grid Alternatives applied for some of those funds, as well as many states that we work in applied for funds and got them. And we received two grants, one to expand our tribal work in the Southwest, and one to work with affordable housing developers across 29 states. So basically half of America, we were planning on solarizing affordable housing in all of those states. So, you know, I spent the bigger part of, you know, this year working on the Midwest and, you know, bringing our program to affordable housing, both single family and multifamily in the Midwest.
And how dependent are you on these grants? Why don't you give us an idea of what it would mean for these opportunities to dry up?
How dependent we are is, you know, there's a lot a lot of other revenue coming into Grid Alternatives. So we've been doing this for 20 years. We certainly can continue and will continue with or without federal support. And what these grants meant for communities like the one I grew up in Michigan was massive, right? It was really taking something that's worked in other places and making that happen in places that often haven't had these opportunities. So, you know, my parents live in Michigan. Their air has been really bad all summer, kind of like some of us in California have experienced before. You know, wildfire smoke descended from Canada and made it so it's really hard to breathe. And when I was meeting with Habitat for Humanity affiliates in Michigan, you know, they were incredibly excited about, oh, you know, finally we're going to be able to provide lower bills for our partner families. And that's something that's so important to us. And especially with aging infrastructure where the lines fall down, you know, snow gets on them, they fall down, you're without power, you're paying heavy bills. So both the families that we were talking to and the partners that we were talking to were incredibly excited about, oh, wow, this could provide needed economic benefit in our communities and needed jobs, right? We were, you know, going to work with mom and pop contractors that might be electrical contractor or roofing contractors, but wanted to expand their base into renewable energy. So this is like, you know, jobs in small town everywhere and energy savings. And so I think the loss that's the biggest is not for our organization. It's for our entire country, and particularly for parts of the middle of our country that may or may not have had any kind of access to renewables and the benefits that renewables can provide in our community. So that's what I feel most sad about. Yeah, you know, we can't do the work if we don't have the money to do the work. So the idea that we were going to solarize affordable housing in 29 states without the funds that were going to pay for us to do that, we can't do that.
I get a little lonely in the middle of the night. I need you, darling, to make things all right. Come on, baby, come on, please. Come on, baby, baby, please. Shine on the light, let it shine on me. Shine on your love light, let it shine on me. A little bit higher, a little bit higher. Just a little bit higher, a little bit higher. A little bit higher.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Erica Mackey. She's the co-founder and co-CEO of Grid Alternatives. So, Erica, where would Grid Alternatives make up this lost revenue from these grants drying up? You said that you've been operating for 20 years plus, and so you're not completely dependent on the Solar for All program, but you've invested in it, obviously. So to just have that rug pulled out from under you, what does it mean operationally for Grid Alternatives?
It means we can't do that work, right? It can't. We dreamed a very big thing. And I will say, once you dream it, it's very hard to put it in the back in the bottle, right? So the dream is out there. And it wasn't just us. It was our communities. It was, you know, states that we're dreaming this dream as well. Families in particular that were like waiting and about to get solar or batteries installed at their homes. But it means we can't do that work. It doesn't mean we can't do work, right? So there's a lot of work that we are doing that is funded at the city or state level, that's funded by philanthropy. That work will continue, and we will continue to talk to you know, anyone who will listen to say, please support our work, right? The more we are able to raise dollars, the more we're able to get donations, the more we're able to scale and expand the work and serve additional folks who need training and need jobs and additional folks who want energy savings. And the very large scale that we were hoping to achieve in the next 5 years, we aren't going to be able to get there without some significant investment in that work, right? So this, you know, just one of our grants was going to serve 37,000 households across 29 states. Most of those, you know, states in, say, the Midwest, the Southwest, the Pacific Northwest, the South. So, you know, we were going to work in all of these states. And, you know, we don't have the answer to how can we do that work without federal dollars. I don't have the answer to that.
And by nature, grants aren't necessarily a long-term financial solution for an organization like yours or one particular grant. But what does it mean that something like renewable energy has been so politicized that the obvious need for cleaner energy has been subsumed by this talking point that it's blue versus red? And what does that mean for an organization like yours moving forward, applying for grants, not just on a federal level, but we could see politicization of this issue on city and state levels as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a hopeful person, so I still continue to believe that regardless of your political party, we all breathe the same air and want to leave a better world for our kids or our neighbors' kids or just, you know, the generations that come after us. I grew up in a really, you know, politically diverse place. You know, people were recycling before their time. You know, it's like this farm community. So it was like, oh, composting and recycling and doing anything you can to, you know, take care of the world that's around you, the nature that's around you, it was important. And I see that consistently. I think it's hard for me to believe that maybe we have politicized the word climate, but I really don't think that average people think solar power is bad.
No, and especially if you look at like the DIY solar movement.
Right? Yeah.
This is coming from Red America, where people, they want to be untrammeled by public utilities and the high the rising costs of utilities. They want to be independent of that. So solar should not be something that is red or blue. It should just be yellow, sun, and green in terms of savings.
Totally, right? Like green in your pocket and green for the air, right? So I think lots of people want to save money on their bills. And all of us are paying increasing amounts of money to utility companies. We just are, right? My bills are big. I know, you know, my friends' bills are big. Grid Alternatives clients' bills are big. So anything we can do that has the benefit of doing something for the world we care about and putting more money in our pockets, it shouldn't be politicized. And so I still really feel hopeful that there's a lot of folks that want to fund that work, that want to make that equitable. So they want, you know, their neighbors who don't have as much money to be able to have access to lower bills, and that there are funders that want to fund that. It might not be this particular funder, but I think there's still a lot of folks that want to support that kind of work and invest in our communities that way.
Is there a way for you and these 60 other recipients to work together to try to move forward, Erica?
I think there's lots of ways, and that group of awardees has been particularly organized. So this whole year, ever since states and tribes and nonprofits got these awards, we've been convening to talk about, you know, oh, your program in Michigan is going to serve these folks, and our program is going to be able to serve these folks. How do we cross-reference people? How do we make sure it's really coordinated? And there's lots of communication between awardees about, you know, rolling out the program, about preserving the program, about how to navigate termination letters. And so there's a lot of community. And I think that sort of goes to the same thing. Like, a lot of entities were dreaming about massive amounts of infrastructure investment in our communities in a way that would really lift up so many folks, bring jobs, and bring savings. And those folks at the center of rolling out that those many, many programs are definitely, you know, linked together because of this collective dream. You know, those dollars were promised to states, to nonprofits, to tribes. They were contracted, and we were counting on being able to do that work for our communities.
So you never even received that money?
We received termination letters. Until then, we were able to do the work and invoice.
So you have been receiving some funds since the Biden administration?
We have been, yes.
She's the co-founder and co-CEO of Grid Alternatives, Erica Mackey. Erica, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Chris Joss, The Rolling Stones, and Bobby Bland.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
This past week, hundreds of Portland area union workers and labor leaders gathered at Berkeley Park in East Moreland to call on Senator Ron Wyden to take a stand against the ongoing genocide in Gaza. For nearly 2 years, Israeli forces have been pounding Gaza with bombs on a daily and nightly basis. The amount of weapons dropped over the past 2 years are the equivalent of 6 atomic bombs. The official death toll is close to 70,000, including at least 20,000 children. But the actual death toll is likely much higher, with some experts estimating it to be in the hundreds of thousands. An estimated 80 to 90% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million Palestinians have been displaced. Most of the homes have been destroyed, and in recent weeks, Israel's ground assault on Gaza City has focused on demolishing the remaining high-rise apartment buildings in the city with controlled demolitions using explosive robots. Since May, when the United Nations Food Distribution Network of over 400 aid distribution sites was replaced with just 4 sites run by the U.S. corporation GHF, the starvation crisis has been severely exacerbated, with an estimated 1 in 4 children in Gaza now facing severe malnutrition. Hundreds of people have been starved to death over the past 4 months. And thousands have been shot by U.S. and Israeli snipers while trying to obtain some food from the Hunger Games-style arenas that pass for aid distribution sites run by Christian Zionist Trump associate Reverend Johnny Moore. In this context, one of Oregon's U.S. senators, Jeff Merkley, has taken a strong and principled stance calling for an end to the U.S. financial and military support for Israel. Merkley 2 weeks ago co-sponsored a bill, along with Chris Van Hollen from Maryland and Bernie Sanders from Vermont, to recognize the state of Palestine. But the other U.S. senator from Oregon, Ron Wyden, has continued to voice unwavering support for the Israeli government and military despite the declaration of genocide in Gaza by the International Court of Justice, the United Nations, and a global consensus of over 150 countries. So the Labor Against Genocide protest focused on pressuring Ron Wyden to recognize the genocide in Gaza and take action in the U.S. Congress to end U.S. support for the genocide. The group rallied at Berkeley Park, then marched to Wyden's house, accompanied by a brass band playing a funeral march and holding mock coffins to symbolize the tens of thousands of civilians killed in Gaza. Here are some excerpts from the rally.
So today we're going to hear from a few speakers, and then we are going to march to Ron Wyden's house in a funeral procession with this art that we have, because we are going to mourn the dead, and we are going to fight like hell for the living, and Ron Wyden needs to know that he can either support an arms embargo, or he can get out of the way, and we will fill his seat with someone who does. Healthcare Workers for Palestine. I stand here today alongside fellow union members, healthcare workers, and prominent Palestinian-led and Jewish-led organizations who have been involved in this work for far longer than I. I wish that I could say that I also stand here with the support and backing of the hospital where I work. But OHSU, along with all other healthcare institutions throughout Portland, has shown that they are unwilling to make a stand on the right side of history. Even the leadership of my own union, Oregon Nurses Association, refused to listen to their delegates and declined to join with the many other unions who endorsed this protest. Shame. These institutions tout mission and value statements promoting the importance of health for all, while pointedly ignoring the thousands of men, women, and children being murdered, starved, and traumatized in Gaza. The complete decimation of healthcare institutions in Gaza, prompting the creation of the term healthicide, is allowed to pass before our eyes with not so much as a casual email from our so-called healthcare leaders.
Shame. Shame.
According to Dr. Joel Abi Rashad, a medical professor at American University of Beirut, the term healthicide encompasses an intentional, systematic destruction of not only healthcare infrastructure, hospitals, healthcare workers, medical supply lines, but also the devastation of a population's health and well-being in its entirety. The hypocrisy demonstrated by our local healthcare systems is biting and deeply telling. selective silence during a genocide is complicity with the perpetrator. It is the tacit agreement that a caste system is just and fair, and the systemic murder of those in the implied lower caste is no issue. I look at the faces of my patients, and I cannot help but think of the faces of starving children, of children being operated on without anesthesia, of children losing their homes and families from bombs funded by my tax dollars. How are there so many people who lack the empathy to do the same? How can anyone who works in healthcare continue to go in day after day, business as usual, without thinking of their healthcare counterparts in Gaza? The doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals who we are literally watching being blown up on live TV while caring for patients. Israel's genocide in Gaza is the most acute and most preventable health catastrophe in the world today. It is a defining ethical test for the global community, and we are failing the people of Gaza every turn. Starvation and malnutrition in Gaza are at all-time high levels. Food insecurity and extreme malnutrition have caused life expectancy at birth to decline 35 years. Families are being forced to risk their lives for a handful of food, and thousands have been brutally murdered while seeking aid. And yet, universal silence. It is not only our healthcare institutions that are refusing to make a stand, but our elected officials as well. Senator Wyden, I ask you, how can you see what is happening and do absolutely nothing? Why have you deemed the people of Gaza less valuable, less deserving of a full and rich life than others? How can you continue to allow our tax dollars to fund these atrocities? And you cannot say you did not know. We're nearly 2 years into this genocide. It is far too late to say you did not know. These crimes are happening in real time, live streamed for the world to see. You can open your phone right now and see children being starved, tortured, and killed by Israeli forces. Israel's actions have turned Gaza into a graveyard for children, and your silence, Senator Wyden, is complicity. We all know that there is a catastrophic public health emergency unfolding in Gaza. How many more human rights organizations, UN agencies, and genocide scholars need to confirm this for our healthcare institutions and elected officials to make a stand? To quote journalist Omar El-Akkad, one day everyone will have been against this. OHSU, Providence, and legacy leadership, will you send emails in 10 years fabricating your stance on this genocide with a performative day of remembrance? Or will you do something, anything now, to support the people of Palestine when they need us most? After 2 years, I know better than to expect much from these health systems. But I believe that if we, as labor, stand together in solidarity and say no, no more bombs, no more starvation, no more occupation, maybe we can accomplish what those in power are too spineless to do. There are far more workers than CEOs, and they must never forget that we are the reason their machines run. We have the power to make our voices heard. Let us continue to stand up and speak out. End the occupation, end the starvation. Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
From the river to the sea!
From the river to the sea!
Palestine will be free!
Palestine will be free!
Okay, next we are going to hear from Sam from the Federal Unionist Network.
It was in 1967 when MLK said, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching a spiritual death." And I think today we can all feel the spiritual death around us. The connection between the increasing military spending and the deliberate erosion of public services is not accidental, but it is part of a strategy that puts profit over people. Under Trump, the already bloated military budget has exploded. He's increased the Department of Defense spending to historic highs. He's nearly tripled the ICE funding, and he's built the largest immigrant detention center in the country.
Shame!
Shame! Meanwhile, military aid to Israel has continued uninterrupted, funding a genocide that our tax dollars is carrying out.
Shame!
Shame!
While billions of dollars flow into the defense contractors and oversee military operations, here we are facing crumbling infrastructure, underfunded schools, unaffordable healthcare, and rising houselessness.
Shame.
Shame.
And these problems are not just a coincidence. They are the direct result of spending choices made at the highest levels of government. And in order to justify that spending, Trump needs us to believe that we are at war. That is why we hear the racist, violent, and false rhetoric about crime rates that have only ever really fallen. They need us to be afraid. Afraid of immigrants, of crime, and afraid of each other. They cut public services and try to convince us that life is a zero-sum game, where someone has something that we do not have. In order to try to convince us that militarism is security, and that we will ignore and even cheer on acts of state violence. This is also why he relentlessly attacks organized labor. Because we know this is that we have more in common with every Palestinian than anyone in the White House. And that's why he attacks organized labor, because it is the biggest obstacle to the authoritarian and billionaire agenda. His attacks on federal employees is a very strategic choice. Federal employees are unionized at higher rates than private sector. Cutting our jobs isn't just taking away services from the working class, but it's also union busting. In fact, they even offered $10,000 bonuses to former federal employees who were illegally fired to go and work for ICE.
Disgusting.
Imagine what we could do with just a fraction of the Pentagon's budget. We could build clinics. We could raise teacher salaries. We could repair bridges and fund universal childcare. And we could invest in clean energy. Budgets themselves are moral documents. They reflect not only what we can afford, but what we value. And it's time that we demand a budget and a future that reflects our values. And if Ron Wyden won't implement it, we will replace him. All right. Free Palestine. Okay, next we are going to hear from Erica Thomas from PSUFA.
Hi everybody, thanks for coming out tonight. My name is Erica Thomas. I'm the co-chair of the Portland DSA Labor Working Group. And I'm also a member of two academic workers unions. One is at PSU, Portland State University, where I'm the co-chair and comms chair of PSUFA, which is the adjunct faculty union at Portland State. You may not know what an adjunct is if you don't work in higher education. So let me just, before I go into sort of tying this together, I'm gonna give you a little bit of a microcosm, and it's going somewhere, I swear. Adjuncts are temp workers. We're hired term to term, we work less than half time, we make a maximum at PSU of around $30,000 a year, though very few adjuncts are offered the maximum classes, so most make less. We make up about 50% of the PSU instructional faculty. We teach 36% of student credit hours, and we're often hired at the last minute, lose classes without warning, or any say in the curricular impact. So PSU is a public institution, and we serve a working class student body. Yep. This is where working class Oregonians and also people from out of state and out of the country go to college. Those students deserve an education in which the educators who are teaching them have their speech protected. The neoliberal university funding deprioritizes humanities, classes that teach histories, develop critical thinking, present confrontational subject matter, and it represses speech on the left in favor of course content that benefits the capitalist class by training these students to become obedient workers. In this environment, the university talks about and encourages students to see themselves as quote-unquote customers, which in turn has an extremely negative impact on shaping the university's programs and priorities academically and also outside of extracurricular activities. This is how campus speech is crushed. An effect of all of this precarity in our working conditions and alienation is that most of us don't know our coworkers, and this makes it incredibly difficult to organize on campus as well. So management knows this and benefits from this. And like I said, it makes us very easy to get rid of. This power that workers have to organize not just about working conditions at our jobs, but to organize along political lines with our coworkers, to leverage that power at our jobs to speak out about Palestine or any other political issue that we wish to, particularly as educators who are responsible for teaching histories to those students, that is a mandatory quality of a public education. We have managed at PSU, at Portland State University's Faculty Association for Adjuncts, which is my union, we've managed to persevere and organize across student and worker groups to form a strong and unified stance. At PSU, those of us who are on the right side of history continue to organize, both inside of our unions, to push them left, and with Faculty and Students for Justice in Palestine, of which I am also a member of the PSU chapter, we organized with students who were part of anti-imperialist student groups. We organized events, teach-ins, and rallies and protests on campus. And I am very proud to say that as of summer 2025, all campus unions unanimously endorsed this rally that you are at right now. You and me need to make it an untenable position to fund this, genocide. It needs to be unacceptable, and we need to replace anybody who is unwilling to stand against it. This needs to become unelectable, whether you are in government or in union leadership. So I want you to say it together with me. When we organize, we win. 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 Solidarity forever.
Yesterday, I saw another video of the thousands of videos that I've now seen of a baby who was just bombed by Israel with a US bomb, and the baby's legs were black and gray and red and charred and bloody. And just still underneath that, you could see like how soft and tender that baby's body was. Their bones weren't even fused together yet. And all I could think about when I saw that was just knowing that this rally was happening today in Ron Wyden's backyard, and knowing that he has raised 5 children and continues to knowingly fund and support this horrific crime. Shame! So we are gonna hear from a representative from AFSCME Local 88.
This country right now is at a critical moment. We in the labor movement have to decide, will we have the courage to bring the ongoing genocide in Palestine into our workplaces, into our personal lives, into our conversations, and every place where we hold even a small amount of power? Or will we be weak-kneed, lily-livered, shivering cowards? Here, in the heart of empire, is where the global shift toward liberation must begin. 25 years ago, I was part of a movement that brought together labor, environmentalists, and radical anarchists to bring down the World Trade Organization to stop the free trade area of the Americas. The global justice movement, calling out global capitalism, dominating the world's resources at the expense of all of us, the poor and working class people around the world. And by the way, if you are working for wages and you have a boss, you're in the working class, so be proud of it. Own it. And know that the union bosses are sometimes just as bad as the labor bosses. Back in 2002, when we brought down the free trade area of the Americas in Miami, labor activists there and across the country pressed the head of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, to divest from Israeli bonds. He didn't budge. But now, for the first time, the Oregon branch of the AFL-CIO has passed a resolution not only condemning the genocide in Gaza, but calling for the national board of the AFL-CIO to divest from Israeli bonds. This only happened because of locals like my own AFSCME Local 88, which was among the first locals to pass a ceasefire resolution. Yes, Local 88. Back into the 2024, we also passed a divestment resolution pressuring the Oregon State Financial Board to divest our retirement funds in the Public Employee Retirement System, or PERS, from Elbit Systems, an Israeli weapons company. The board told our union that they are no longer invested in Elbit. So, victory there, but it's recently come out that because they invested in mutual funds, they don't even know what companies our public employees' retirement funds are invested in. This is outrageous. As a state, as people, taxpayers in this state, we need to demand full and complete disclosure and divestment. Resolutions are great and powerful, but they only go so far. Words don't speak as loudly as actions. Like Palestine Action in the UK. Since the beginning of the unions, since the beginning of wage labor, every worker knows that the most effective action is collective direct action. So following the lead of workers in port cities in Europe and the Arab world, do whatever it takes to stop the manufacture, transport, and sale of weapons to the death machines of the Israeli and US militaries. Respond to the call of over 500 trade unions and organizations in Palestine, calling on all of us to boycott, divest, and sanction the apartheid state of Israel until it falls just like apartheid fell in South Africa in 1994. As the great labor leader Cesar Chavez said, yes, we can. Si se puede. Si se puede. Si se puede.
Si se puede.
Union workers worldwide,
stand against the genocide!
All right, next we are going to hear from Angela Bonilla, the president of the Portland Association of Teachers.
As y'all know, my name is Angela Bonilla. I use she, they, ella pronouns, and I represent almost 5,000 educators as president of the Portland Association of Teachers. We are in a fight for our collective humanity. Every day, we are seeing babies, children, adults starving to death on our phone screens. We're seeing people's water polluted by AI programs. We're seeing people kidnapped because of the color of their skin or their accent when they speak. What happens in Gaza, in Yemen, in Iran, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Congo, happened and will happen again in the US. We have no other option but to fight. And those who profit from the war machine, who are too afraid to throw away the propaganda they've been fed, will tell you that this isn't an education issue. We should just stay in our lane. Well, there is not a single school building or university that existed in Gaza in 2022 that is still there. The only schools left are the makeshift classrooms the remaining educators have created to give a semblance of normalcy for our children. The libraries left are those college students reading their books by a flame, attempting to complete their studies. And I say our children because these are all our children, every single one. If education is being denied to any child, it is unacceptable. We have no option but to show up and fight back. And those same people will tell you that it's not a labor issue, that we should just focus on bread and butter issues. Well, there is no bread or butter if our nation continues to invest in creating and transporting bombs instead of investing in education, in green infrastructure, and workforce training at home and abroad. There is no bread and butter when politicians are more interested in maintaining their political contributions than in maintaining your freedom of speech. We have no option but to show up and fight back. So tonight we grieve. We come together to grieve and love and remember. As Cornel West said, the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. We must let those atrocities be seen, be spoken, be felt through our tears. But do not allow that grief to consume you or falsely empower you to speak over those who are harmed. Let it wash over you. Let it cleanse you of the capitalist and imperialist stains on your body, as you know deeply, deeper than anything else you've ever known, that another world is possible. It is being born right now through each of us, reflected in every single tear. And do not forget, we must grieve so we remember why we fight.
We know the polling shows the majority of Americans across party lines say that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. The majority of Americans across party lines say that we need an arms embargo now. And Ron Wyden can either get the message or get out of the way. There is a sister city petition to end our sister city relationship with Israel. Portland has a sister city relationship with Ashkelon, Israel, which is a major port where a lot of military equipment is being shipped through right now. So that petition and other resources are at linktr.ee/rainbowblock, the Rainbow Block link tree. Jewish Voice for Peace is having an action here, no, sorry, at Ron Wyden's office at 911 Northeast 11th Avenue on Thursday, October 2nd.
Those were the sounds of the Labor Against Genocide protest held recently at the home of U.S. Senator Ron Wyden in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Radio Zine on KBOO Radio.
KBOO Portland 90.7 FM y en la internet kboo.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes